19. After 3,000 years or so, their population must be in the tens of millions, hundreds of millions.
Or they control their own reproductive rate.
Or they don't all live underground.
We know that. The Achachiruna are partly underground and partly in the forest.
So let's say the folk really do live underground except at harvest time and planting time. They didn't always. They must have begun their colony on the surface where the sun shines.
Probably.
Why did they make the move underground?
I bet you think you know.
They found out that the ravens and kias couldn't share the surface world with humans. The Achachiruna were fine. I think they're the ones that have educated ravens and kias so well in human languages and history and all. But the only way to keep the peace was for the humans to live as far as they could from the mischief of the kias.
They're just playing.
Savagely and selfishly. So the folk gave up the surface, except for crops, and underground they set up a water and sewer and ventilation system, and then carved out whatever they needed. The birds couldn't thrive down there, nothing for them to eat, and they need room to fly. So the birds live on the surface, and the engineers swing around in the trees. And you can't tell me that there isn't a substantial group down below who deeply resent the bargain their ancestors made and are agitating to return to the surface, which would mean war. And now you and Peter and Wang Mu make friends with the ravens and kias and the engineers, and you set us up as allies of one side and foes of the other.
For reasoning based on guesses, based on hypotheses, based on doubtful premises, you've built a pretty elaborate structure.
We need to meet with the folk. And we shouldn't be led to them by the surface dwellers. We should go straight down. Appear among them without intermediaries.
Because people always trust visitors who magically appear in their house. Conversation. Thulium and Sprout. Quoted in Pleaked. Leguminidae.
Peter and Wang Mu arrived in the meadow near the council trees, and in a few moments a raven dropped down into the grass. Are you phoenix, or dog, or some raven we haven't talked with before? The bird flew up to Wang Mu's shoulder. Greetings, Royal Mother of the West. Well, we know you're not royal son, said Wang Mu. So at least you can tell kias from ravens. Peter decided it was time for him to speak up. We can tell corvids from parrots, and we can tell hawks from vultures. We have no vultures in our world, said Dog, for Peter now recognized her voice and style of speech. Do the folk underground still have the frozen embryos of falcons and other predatory birds? Asked Peter. Why would you want to know? Asked Dog. They have obviously been selective about what Earth species they introduced into this world. I think part of your understanding with them is that they will never introduce more predatory birds into the nest, said Peter.
We fear brood parasites far more than flying predators. We can deal with hawks and falcons, but brood parasites attack us in the nest, killing our own babies, so we'll raise theirs.
I can't imagine that ravens or kias would be fooled, said Peter.
We are the birds who speak with humans, said Dog. We have to speak for all the birds and try to keep them safe.
Do they appreciate your intervention on their behalf? Asked Peter. He could feel Wang Mu growing more anxious. He was treading in perilous territory now, he knew.
Those that understand, yes, said Dog. But what difference would it make if they were all ungrateful to us? They still need us, and we will still stand for them.
Because there is a history of conflict between humans and birds, said Peter. Silence. Dog flew off Wang Mu's shoulder and disappeared in the trees. Peter immediately lay down in the grass. It's a little damp, he said. Either a heavy dew this morning or it rained last night.
Not afraid of damp, said Wang Mu, lying down close by.
They knew Dog might be 3 minutes or 3 hours in her conversation with the council, and they didn't want to wear themselves out with standing around uselessly.
I'm betting, said Wang Mu, that you have now proven Thulium's theory,
Peter said. One of her guesses
It doesn't rise to the level of a... The separation of sentient species did not arise out of mutual convenience. It arose as a way of settling either a war or a chronic conflict that everyone feared might turn into war.
That's what I think we're confirming here, said Peter.
And what difference will it make, knowing that? Asked Wang Wu.
It's easier to make good decisions when you have more information, said Peter.
And you think Thulium may be paranoid and overly suspicious, but she also might be right, said Wang Wu.
She may be little, but she's smart, said Peter.
When we know almost nothing except by rumor, said Wang Wu, our guesses are neither smart nor dumb. What's dumb is to trust those guesses and take irrevocable actions based on them.
But taking no action at all is also dumb.
The great human dilemma, said Wang Wu. We always act or fail to act based on insufficient information. And yet we muddle through, recovering from our mistakes as best we can.
Quote from Han Feize?
No, said Wang Wu. I think I was quoting you.
Ah, said Peter. No wonder it sounded so wise to me.
If it sounds wise, I must be quoting someone? Asked Wang Wu.
If you want to take offense, said Peter, then it doesn't matter what I actually say. At which point a raven fluttered over them and landed on Peter's knee, which happened to be upraised at the moment.
Yes, said Dog. In the second century of the colony, some humans were so furious with the Kia that they started making traps for them and caging them where they could do no harm to humans' projects. When the ravens saw it and heard the grieving of the free Kias, the ravens declared a relentless guerrilla war against the village of humans who had done this thing.
Guerrilla war? Asked Peter.
We carry no weapons but our talons and beaks, said Dog. But we are as good at mobbing our enemies as the Kias and Crows. The humans could go nowhere, do nothing out in the open without constant bombardment, pecking, tearing. Everything they built we broke or weakened, and when that proved not to be enough, we began pecking at their faces, tearing their ears, causing them to bleed down over their eyes. We never blinded any of them, though we could have. We wanted this to be a war whose scars might heal. How did they fight you? Asked Wang Mu. They tried to swat us out of the air. They reinvented the bow and arrow, but they were horrible marksmen. To avoid us, many of them in that village took refuge underground. We were content to let them escape us that way, as long as they weren't out where they could be annoyed by the Kias.
Then what? Asked Wang Mu.
We opened the cages and set the Kias free, said Dog. That was the foundation of our alliance.
Peace ever since? Asked Wang Mu.
Every few centuries, some group of humans gets on about taking back the surface with slogans like, we made them smart, now make them obedient.
Ah, said Peter. They acted and talked like humans.
But they didn't make us smart, said Dog. We made ourselves smart during the voyage and after, when we controlled our mating and child-rearing.
Slogans don't have to be accurate to be effective, said Peter.
Why does this matter to you? Asked Dog. It's all history. One member of our team suggested that the longer we wait to meet the folk underground, the more suspicious of us they might become, said Wang Wu. If any of them feel resentment against ravens and Kias, won't they mistrust us as allies of the birds? Do you really think, asked Dog, that after the way your craft appeared in our sky and hopped around instantaneously, and after you appeared on the surface without any kind of craft at all, they would mistrust you because you were friends with us?
Fair point, said Peter.
I have seen your home planet, Lusitania, said Dog. I already reported to the Echachiruna that your level of technology on the planet's surface is not superior to our own. Only your means of travel.
That's true enough on Lusitania, said Peter. But you met the Hive Queen. She has all the memories of her species. She knows how to build extraordinary starships and death-dealing surface weapons. She knows how to burn your planet to cinders. She will not do it, but don't judge our technological capabilities solely on the basis of what we have on hand. If it came to war, nobody wages more terrible war than the Formics.
Except the humans, said Dog.
Well, said Peter, that goes without saying.
Your war would not be against birds, but against humans, said Dog.
There is no war, said Wang Wu. There will be no war, because we will not raise any weapons against you, and if you raise a weapon against us, we'll simply go away.
Dog walked on Peter's knee, circling while thinking of what to say, it seemed. Her claws bit through the fabric into the skin of Peter's knee, causing tiny stabs of pain. Yet her movements also tickled him, so he wanted to laugh and complain at the same time.
I have an idea, said Dog. Take whatever samples you can gather in the next couple of hours, and then leave. Go back to your planet, take your box out of the sky, and then forget that you know of the existence of Nest.
Peter thought, that may be the wisest advice we'll ever get. And he also thought, we haven't yet learned enough about the Descolada. Or do we have enough data now that if we left Nest completely, we could work out the Descolada's mysteries on our own?
It is not our decision to make, said Wang Wu.
When you say that, said Dog, you mean that you, Royal Mother of the West, and your husband, Peter Wiggin II of that name, cannot make the decision about your future course of action without winning the consent of the other members of your team?
Yes, said Peter.
As you also need to consult the Council of Ravens.
But, Peter Wiggin, said Dog, will you advocate for your leaving Nest and never coming back?
I will tell them your proposal, and I will rehearse for them all of the arguments in its favor.
But also the arguments against it? Asked Dog. He won't have to do that, said Wang Mu. The others will unite to present those counter-arguments, and they will overwhelmingly decide to come to Nest and meet with the underground folk.
Don't come with them, said Dog. Peter felt Wang Mu preparing to speak, and he knew she wanted to say what he wanted to say. Why not? But he touched his hand to her hand, and they both said nothing. Peter felt that Dog was giving them a warning, but that she could not be more explicit than she already had been. She was advising them to stay away for their own good. She was warning them that if they went down to meet with the folk in their underground lairs, it would come to no good. And yet the Descolada researchers would come again and go underground, and whatever dire consequence Dog foresaw would happen. All I need to do, said Peter, is to stay on Lusitania with my wife and my gestating child. Let the others go without me. I'm not their leader. I'm not a leader of any kind, not even to Wang Mu. They don't need me. If we stay behind, we will be safe. That's what I'm going to do, he decided. I'm going to stay on Lusitania when everybody else overrules us and comes back down here. Now the question is, will Wang Mu stay with me? Or will she decide to put our child at risk by joining the expedition? And then, what choice would I have, except to change my mind and go?
Thulium had learned to speak and understand Japanese at an early age, though she tried not to show the others what she was doing. They would mock her for yearning for her mother so much that she would try to learn the language of Nokonoshima. Aunt Carlotta was the only one who guessed, and that was probably due to Sprout, who noticed Thulium's actions more than anybody else. Carlotta said to her one day, "You do know that on Nokonoshima, everyone speaks Stark, just like every other planet in the Hundred Worlds." "I assume," said Thulium. "But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't learn Japanese, so I can read ancient books and watch ancient vids." And that's as far as the conversation went. Thulium realized that her mother's refusal to join father on Lusitania was a rational choice, but it didn't mean mother did not wish to meet her only daughter. The twins she had met, Thulium knew them too well to think they might have made a good impression. She also knew herself, and how bad an impression she, too, was likely to make. "But if I go to Nokonoshima, to Iri's house in Tochoji, and I do my best to be patient and kind and loving and obedient, then if she still doesn't like me, that only means that she would not have loved me no matter how events had gone. And I will let go of that childish fantasy." What she absolutely would not do was transport Mother Eyrie to Lusitania against her will, not just because Jane would never tolerate such a thing and would surely send Mother back at once, but also because love does not compel. That was the lesson that growing up with Sargent as her father had taught her. Love does not compel. Love like Aunt Carlotta's for her children, and for Thulium herself. Walking along the streets of Nakonoshima, Thulium could feel the furtive glances of the people she passed. They were too polite to stare openly, except a few very small children. But she could see that her Lusitanian garb was sadly out of fashion here, and probably had never been in fashion anywhere. Thulium thought of going into a shop and buying local clothing, but before she tried it, she remembered that she had nothing that would pass for money here, and that her Stark would have a pronounced accent. She didn't want to create a stir, just find her mother. She appreciated the fact that ancient characters were rarely used on signs. The Roman alphabet of Stark and English was used on every world, so she was able to find the street she had heard mentioned. It had many apartment buildings, though none was more than two stories high. This colony was too new and uncrowded to need high-rise buildings. Still, it would be a challenge to enter every one of the buildings and try to find her mother's name on a mailbox or address list. But what was she thinking? She walked behind a delivery truck parked on the street and then made her twisting jump into the lobby of the first apartment building. She searched the listed names and then asked the man who seemed to be the guardian of the place, "Does Eyrie live here?"
"No one by that name," he said. "I'm so sorry to disappoint you."
She believed that he actually meant it. In some buildings, she had to leap floor to floor because the names were beside the doors instead of in a central place. But the process was still far faster than it would have been had she been required to climb up and down stairs. And then she came to a block of standalone houses, narrow and close together, but with no shared walls. The third house she checked had the name Wigan on the mailbox. Since that was obviously not a common Japanese name, Thulium walked to the door and clapped. Soon the door opened, and an elderly lady bowed to her. Thulium's heart sank. Her mother could not possibly be that old.
"No, no, don't be disappointed," said the old woman. "I am not Mrs. Wigan. That will be my daughter who owns this house."
"Is your daughter's name Eyrie?" asked Thulium. Apparently, her emotions showed on her face.
"If I am not guessing wrong, I believe you are my long-lost granddaughter, Thulium."
The woman extended her hands, and Thulium bounded forward and they embraced long and hard.
"My father never told me that my mother lived with her mother," said Thulium.
"I took great pains to make sure I was off visiting friends when he lived here. He and I did not get along."
"He doesn't get along with anyone," said Thulium.
Grandmother changed the subject, as any polite person would.
"Please come in and sit with me. Eyrie will be home from the market very soon now, and then you can prepare dinner with us."
"I have no experience with cooking," said Thulium.
"But after tonight, you will have had some experience."
They sat in the front room, on comfortable chairs, and Thulium listened as grandmother told stories of when Eyrie was young and had friends and was pursued by fine young men.
"And then a strange man came from another world," said Thulium, anticipating where it all ended. "And he ruined her life."
"He fulfilled her life," said grandmother. "Eyrie was madly in love with him, and she bore him three babies, twin boys and a daughter. Her husband insisted on giving them nonsensical names, rare earth elements, but Eyrie thought, 'I will get used to any name, just to have these children in my life.' You lived here in this very house for 3 weeks, Thulium.
You crawled in your first week. Your body developed so quickly. It was going to be thrilling to watch you grow, because unlike your brothers, you had a sweet and loving disposition. Then one day, Irie came home from market, and her babies were gone.
Were you here?
I was, said Grandmother. I asked him where he was taking you. He said, to the park, and since he had often done that, why would I doubt him? By then the twins were sturdy walkers, so your father carried you and led them out, and so I told your mother when she got home. We waited up all night for him to bring you home.
He didn't even tell you we were gone? Asked Thulium.
After the spaceship was out of Nokonoshima's atmosphere, he sent a message by Ansible. A text message, not even a vid. And that was when your mother's life ended.
But she's alive, said Thulium.
Of course, said Grandmother. But she takes little interest in anything. Your father did provide for her. He bought this house, as well as several apartment buildings, to provide her with a good income. At first, she wanted to refuse all his aid. He had her babies. Why would she care about his money? But I am her mother, and I prevented her from doing something flamboyantly stupid in her grief and rage.
So father did provide for her.
Oh, the widow Wiggin is well known for her charitable works and her kind treatment of her tenants. You see that we live simply, not lavishly, so there is always money for her to help those who need it.
Then they talked of other things, half in Japanese and half in Stark, until the door opened, and a strikingly lovely woman entered the room, carrying two mesh bags of vegetables and fruits. Irie stopped when she saw her mother's face. Then she looked where her mother was looking.
Are you? Asked Irie.
Thulium rose to her feet, then bowed deeply before her mother.
I apologize for my father's decisions and actions, and I grieve that I did not have a chance to grow up in your care.
Irie embraced her and wept, and then they sat together, her mother's arms about her, and talked and talked. Thulium didn't notice when Grandmother got up. Only when Grandmother returned and told them that supper was ready did Thulium realize she had left the room. They ate together, a traditional Japanese meal, or at least the version that was traditional in Tochoji. They talked gently with each other. Only when the food was gone and the bowls were taken into the kitchen did someone ask the question that they were afraid to ask.
Thulium, said Irie, did your father bring you?
No, said Thulium. I brought myself. No one knows that I'm here.
Grandmother nodded and said,
this next generation was bound to be miraculous.
Do you have to go back? Asked Irie.
I have responsibilities, said Thulium. We are on the verge of crucial decisions and decisive actions.
Will you stay this night? Asked Irie. A night with my own daughter under the same roof?
I would not stop talking to you until you fell asleep, said Thulium, and then I would stay awake, memorizing your face. Yet it's almost morning now on the planet where we live and work, and I will need to have some sleep before I get back to work. So I need to leave in a few minutes.
I'm sure that was a weakness in your Japanese, said Irie. The word you meant to use was hours.
Minutes. Dear Mother Irie, said Thulium, but 1,000 hours of remembering this beautiful evening, the happiest in my life.
Change the worlds, my daughter, said Irie. I always knew you would.
Anyone can change the world, said Thulium, but to change it for the better, that's always the challenge.
More things were said,
and eventually it was well over an hour before Thulium stood in the middle of the sitting room and said her goodbyes. She would not hide her power from Mother Eyrie and Grandmother. Thulium stood there in their plain sight, and then she was on Lusitania as the first blush of dawn appeared in the eastern sky. She arrived outdoors, on the meadow beyond the fence. She meant to run to the gate and then catch a few hours of sleep, but instead she lay down, collapsed rather, and wept for joy and sorrow.
I will never regret meeting my mother, thought Thulium, though it makes me miss her even more. And grandmother is a blessing I had never thought possible. How can an orphan like me have a grandmother?
It was there, weeping, that she fell asleep. Hours later, she awoke feeling stiff and damp, but she quickly recovered her limberness and walked to the gate.
Did you sleep well?
Asked the Pecanino on watch. Of course they had known she was there. Nothing passed on Lusitania without the Pecaninos knowing it.
I did, said Thulium. Thank you for letting me use your beautiful bed for a few hours.
You are always welcome here, Thulium, said the Pecanino.
Thulium wondered if she knew him, if he was one of the Pecaninos from Cubae. But the thought soon passed out of her mind. She could hardly tell Pecaninos apart, even though she could plainly see that there were many different facial structures among them. It was a sign of carelessness and inattention on her part. She knew that. And yet she was still too full of her visit with her wonderful mother and grandmother to trouble herself about anything as trivial as telling Pecaninos apart.